Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
The Alps have seen the march of armies, the flow of pilgrims and crusaders, the feats of mountaineers and the dreams of engineers, and some 14 million people live among their peaks today. In the Alps, Stephen O'Shea takes readers up and down these majestic mountains, journeying through their 500-mile arc across France, Italy, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, Germany, Austria and Slovenia. Everything from Hannibal's Crossing and how the Alps have influenced everything from Frankenstein to Heidi and the Sound of Music, and not forgetting sites of wars. In fact, the Italians' retreat in the First World War and Hitler's notorious Eagle's Nest. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the United States, author of The Alps, A Human History from Heidi to Hannibal, or from Hannibal to Heidi and beyond, Stephen O'Shea. Stephen, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good to have you. Good to have you with us, indeed. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the Alps have never really been looked at in the way you have in this book, and yet they are so full of history and so full of romance and drama and dramatic events.
Yes, that's true. You know, when I was writing the book, I, of course, did some research. In English, there's very, very little that takes in all of the Alps. I think the last person to have done it was Mark Twain at the end of the 19th century.
Good grief.
So I had the field open to myself. And just because it was so, it's such a large area of land, I decided to do it in a muscle car, going up and down the mountains, going over the major passes. Because the Alps, of course, is about peaks, but it's also they're also about passes. Because when you start in one valley and you go to over a pass to the next, you usually end up someplace entirely different. There's different language, there's different culture, there's different cuisine. You know, in Colorado, you go across the mountains and you end up where you started from after you cross a pass. But in the Alps, of course, there's so much variety.
Just want to stop you right there because I'm a complete petrol head. What muscle car did you take?
It was a limited edition Mayan Sport, little compact car with 285. Horsepower.
Ooh,
and baby, it could move. And of course, it was a limited edition, so all the gearheads like yourself, when I would park anywhere, would come out of nowhere to stare at it because it was such a powerful car.
So we have. I could talk about you about the mountain passes, the Alpine routes, the whole bits and pieces, and there's a whole motoring history, and that could well be your next book in that thing. But where do you start then with the Alps? Do you start with the iconic ones, like Hannibal taking a herd of elephants across the Alps, which is sort of popular culture run mad because that didn't actually happen the way it did it.
Well, we don't know where exactly he crossed the Alps. He definitely crossed the Alps, and there were definitely elephants. That's not fable. I mean, it's in the historical record. I go west to east. I started in Lake Geneva and then I end in Trieste. So the Western Alps, the big monsters, are the ones that I start with, and those are the ones that Hannibal crossed in 218 B.C., and we more or less know his route. He didn't want to take hug the coast because the coast was not clear. So he had to go about 100 miles further north and then cross from what is now France into Italy. We think it's the Mont Cenis Pass that he crossed. And, of course, there are big Napoleon thought that, so Napoleon built a monument to Hannibal, as Napoleon thought he was a latter-day Hannibal, of course. So, but there are competing passes for it. You see monuments to Hannibal in about four different passes.
And I suppose one of the things is about the Alps is, I just thinking when you said, you know, you started in Geneva and there's great monsters and you end up in Trieste, and the huge cultural differences. I mean, we seem to think of the Alps at first glance as, yes, okay, chocolate box mountains, you know, Sound of Music, people running around in sort of Swiss nationalist, you know, lederhosen or alpine wear. But there is a tremendous difference in cultures, and it really is a melting pot.
Absolutely. The you know, you go from the Latin Romance languages to Germanic languages and end up with Slavic languages. And there's also a huge melting pot, was a good word for it. There's the lard line, which I described, is where on one side of the line people cook with animal fat, and on the other side they cook with olive oil. So you leave one place in Switzerland where they have that disgusting dish called a rosti, which is like a sloppy Joe with bacon.
Right.
And then you go to the other side, and suddenly you're in Lombardy, where everything is pesto and beautiful salads and tomatoes. And you've only driven for about 10 minutes, but you cross this invisible lard line, which I kept doing. I kept crisscrossing back and forth. And, of course, all of the different traditions. It's interesting. We said 14 million people, but most of them can't understand each other, because the languages are so different.
And I suppose that comes from having been spending a lot of time sort of cut off from each other during because of the weather and the environment and the geography of the region. So you will get, you know, pockets, cantons or whatever, where some speak Lombardy, some speak Italian, German. So a real melting pot, as I said before.
And in the Dolomites, you have people who speak a language called Ladin, L-A-D-I-N, which is a descendant of what the Roman legionaries used to speak. It's not at all like Italian. It's a Romance language. But you have several different languages. You have Friuli, which is another language. And, of course, in Switzerland, Swiss German changes from valley to valley. And that's one of their national identity thing, is to try to hammer out a German that all Swiss can understand and that all Germans cannot.
Mm. How long did the actual trip take, and when did you undertake it? Because presumably, like very few places on Earth, the character of the Alps changes, obviously, with the seasons.
Yes, I took it in the summertime, because taking it in the wintertime, first of all, the passes are mostly closed, so I'd end up spending all the time in the tunnels, and everything is white, and you can't really see the ground. So I did it in the summertime, the last World Cup, actually, 2014. I spent 3.5 months going up and down, and, you know, every now and then I would get out of the car and hike and climb, but the book is about, as its subtitle underlines, it's about the human geography of the Alps. It's not about the geology of the Alps at all, because the Alps, of course, have changed so much, especially in the last 200 years. It was a backwater. It was a very afflicted with the goiters of cretinism, because they couldn't eat any seafood. No iodine in the diet, and it's gone from being one of the poorest regions of Europe to one of the richest, a lot because of tourism and winter sports. A lot of that is due to that. And, you know, it's also an engineering Disneyland. It's the road and rail engineering in the Alps is truly stunning.
Because we tend to think about it as the Alps as just being now winter sports and, you know, Swiss chocolate box and, you know, millionaires, you know, on the lakes. But, you know, as you said, that's a great description. It really has been an engineering Disneyland. There's tremendous feats of tunnels and bridges and all those sorts of spans. I mean, muscular industry in the Alps in terms of things like the salt miners and the people who construct the bridges.
You know, there are all sorts of industries. That there are sawmills. There's a lot of agriculture. I actually saw people on the upper reaches of some of the Swiss Alps wearing lederhosen and herding sheep. There are still pockets of people doing traditional work. In Slovenia, the last of the Alpine countries I visited, is a very, very industrial developed place. So it's not just tourism there at all. But, I mean, tourism, of course, in the Savoy, where Chamonix and Mont Blanc are, and then around Zermatt, the Matterhorn, of course, that's a tourist mecca. I called the Matterhorn the minarets of Europe, because at the foot of the Matterhorn is the town of Zermatt, which is like a brigadoon of bling. It's all luxury shops, and there are people from all over the world. It's like a gigantic bazaar. But that's a facet of the Alps, but it's not the entirety of the Alps. Because the Alps are just too big. They just they will not be tamed, despite all the engineering. It's also a very dangerous place.
And it's been a place where you've seen some sort of horrendous events. I mean, we talk about the crossing of the Alps by Hannibal, but the Italian retreat in the First World War, there were horrendous losses of life during that, during the, was it 1917, 1918?
That's right. There were 11 battles, 12 battles fought in the same place, in the Alps, the easternmost Alps. And the Italians had to retreat from Caporetto, which has gone down in Italian history and in world history as a synonym for disaster. But the White War, as it was called, more people died from avalanches. They were the front lines were in the mountains, and some of the trenches were made of ice. The pictures are unbelievable. And for 4 years, the Austro-Hungarians and the Italians faced each other across these valleys, and sometimes on the same slope, until 1918, when the Germans completely obliterated the Italians and tossed them almost all the way back to Venice. But the White War was truly, among all the stupidities of the First World War, that had to be the stupidest one, I think.
And of course, we had Hitler, who was very fond of giving himself titles like Wolf's Lair, of course, his place in the forest, and he had Eagle's Nest up in the mountains, which had incredible views and that great picture window. And if you remember the series Band of Brothers, I think it was Eagle's Nest that they went to and liberated.
That's right, and then they turned it into a rest and relaxation center for the American Army for several years before they finally handed it over back to the Bavarian government in the middle of the 50s. What's funny about the Eagle's Nest is, of course, it is a fantastic feat of engineering. The views are Olympian, but Hitler was an acrophobe, and so he visited it less than a dozen times, and only for about an hour at a time. He would just use it to impress foreign dignitaries. Everyone would go up, walk around, and then Hitler would retreat further down the mountain to where Obersalzburg, which was where he lived, which was not as far up the mountain. But the Eagle's Nest is, now it's one gigantic restaurant, but the views from it are just amazing. And across the way is Austria, where they filmed The Sound of Music. So when the Von Trapp family is walking over the mountain at the end, supposedly to Switzerland, they're actually walking directly to the Eagle's Nest, which is...
Whoops, yeah. And effortlessly, that takes me into the next link, because not only has it been the side of history, but the Alps had a huge impact on the world of literature, of culture as well, because obviously there is the Sound of Music, and nobody forget Julie Andrews waltzing across the meadow and the whole of the Von Trapp family. But also, you know, we have Heidi, which, again, if you think the Alps, you think Heidi, and we have, it's the site of Holmes's death, of course.
Yes, Holmes was polished off by Conan Doyle in the Alps by the Reichenbach Falls, which is a wonderful waterfall right in central Switzerland. Apparently, Conan Doyle just was tired of Sherlock Holmes, and he decided to kill him there. And he had to bring him back by popular demand about 10 years later, saying that no, Holmes and Moriarty did not fall down into the torment. Holmes managed to grab a rock, and he'd been in hiding for 10 years, and here he is in the Hound of the Baskerville. But more important, the Alps is the birthplace of Romanticism, which is incredibly important. Rousseau was the one who convinced people to love the mountains and to love the terror that they inspire. Prior to that, the mountains were detested, thought to be the home of dragons. and pestilence. Rousseau changed all that, and then, of course, Byron and Mary Shelley and Percy Bysshe Shelley spent a lot of time on Lake Geneva, especially the year without a summer, which was in 1816, because of a huge explosion. This is where getting into the weeds here. A huge volcanic explosion in Indonesia thrust so much soot into the air that there was snow.
Was that Krakatoa, wasn't it? That was the Krakatoa explosion, wasn't it, I think?
No, it's another mountain. It's okay. Bigger than Krakatoa, but its name escapes it.
All right.
So these three artists of genius were stuck on Lake Geneva with these incredible electrical storms and, you know, in the middle of the summertime, and they would just tell ghost stories to each other to scare each other. And they had a bet. Who could write the scariest novel? And, of course, what came out of that was Frankenstein and Frankenstein's monster, which occurs in the much of it occurs in the Alps. So not only did it give birth to Romanticism, it gave birth to the Gothic novel and then to, in many ways, the avatar of science fiction.
Ah.
So the Alps are incredibly important in the history of thought.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you say that the mountains were shunned by people, and they were thought to be the place of dragons, and they were thought to be a place of pestilence. And now, of course, I mean, alpine living, you can hardly move for a bowl of healthy muesli or whatever, alpine based. I mean, people flock to the mountains for healthy living. And if you said there were dragons up now, the current thing of Game of Thrones would be up there like a shot as well. Isn't it interesting how the whole culture's done a 360?
That's right, and 180 actually. But
sorry, thank you.
But you can tell by some of the names of the peaks give away what people thought of them. Like near Mont Blanc, there's a Mount Rotten, and then
Mount Rotten,
Mount Mont Pourri, Mount Rotten, and then there's elsewhere in the Savoy, there's a Mont Maudit, which is a cursed mountain. So they. The mountains were not loved, they were feared, and they were seen as the obstacles that they are. You know, the Alps are rude, they sort of just get in the way. If you're going from Paris to someplace important like Rome, then you have to deal with these huge obstacles. And of course, there was no explanation for them until quite recently, when the science of geology accounted for them. Because mountains are not mentioned in Genesis. So people in the early modern period, in the medieval period, scratched their head and said, well, what accounts for these things? There's no explanation for them to be found in the Bible.
How did you find the reaction then of the people who have been living there for centuries, that you know, the native mountain people, if you like, and then these new arrivists, you know, all the, you know, the extreme, the snow people, if you, you know, the snowboarders, the skiers, the people who have put the alpine resorts, is there a resentment, do you think, towards them, or do you think that they all get along quite nicely now, you know, living in the mountains?
I think there's a peaceful, self-interested coexistence. The outsiders, the lowlanders, want the thrill of the heights and the thrill of extreme sports. The locals are amused, and they're also incidentally enriched by these people. So there is a peaceful coexistence. Traffic can get annoyingly dense in the summertime. Especially people with campers and caravans, because these passes are quite high and there's thousands of hairpin turns. But you know, you will always have a local honking at you from behind you, who is annoyed with the traffic. But more or less, a peaceful coexistence, I would say.
What was the most surprising and unexpected piece of research that you came across, or you know, did you turn a corner or came through one of some alpine pass and just thought, well, this is just absolutely either out of central casting from The Sound of Music, or this is so bizarre and quaint and otherworldly that if you know, hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I wouldn't believe it.
I'd have to say it was when I saw the Dolomites in northeastern Italy. I'd been warned that the Dolomites were unlike any other alpine range, and they indeed are. It's not a range, it's just these enormous, enormous rocks, if you wish, pinnacles, that stand independent of each other. They're like gigantic sculptures. skyscrapers in a way. Le Corbusier, the Swiss architect, called the Dolomites the most beautiful buildings in the world. And so you have stunning perspectives, stunning colors, because they change because of the nature of their formation, of their mineral formation. It's a kind of quartz called dolomite. They change color according to the time of day. So what starts out as gray can be gray in the morning, can be pink at midday, and then red at sunset. So the Dolomites were, for me, was just a magical place. And in the book, my chapter devoted to the Dolomites, I talk about all of the fairy tales and legends and folklore inspired by the Alps, but more particularly by the Dolomites. And you can see why, because these mountains are just magical and mystical.
Actually, that's the only one of the only bits of the Alps that I actually skied, Dolomites. So yeah, I understand what you're talking about there. What was your favorite bit of road then? As you were, what was your favorite alpine pass, or what was your favorite tunnel? Because they have some absolutely monster tunnels as well.
Well, I can tell you, the scariest was the Furka Pass in Switzerland.
Is that what you yelled out as you went through it, you mother?
That was the one I had to back up because of a bus. I had to back up around the hairpin turn with a drop of a kilometer on about a few inches from the passenger side. But the most spectacular is the Stelvio Pass between Italy and Switzerland, which has, I think, 49 hairpin turns. And there are several places that you can pull over, and you just don't believe that you have driven this crazy noodle of black noodle of roadway. And of course, the road, the views are insane. And when you get to the top, you're at a place where there's a meeting of three languages. There's Italian, German from Austria, and Ladin, as I mentioned before, that Roman legionary language. So that's sort of like the icing on the cake. You drive up this insane road, insanely scary road, and then when you reach the pass, you're in a place of human geography that's quite spectacular because of three separate languages and three separate cuisines.
And I have to ask you this question. I mean, you were in the Alps for a good 3 months or so. Did you ever feel the need to take up yodeling lessons, and did you get involved with any of the local, you know, the folklore, as it were?
I was interested in yodeling. I was traveling with a Swiss person for a while who gave me a sort of a seminar, a master class in yodeling, telling me the difference between Swiss yodeling, which is far more staccato, than Austrian yodeling, which is what we normally think of. It's very sweet and syrupy. I did see people yodel spontaneously. Once a car went by and there was a young man in it, and he was yodeling at the top of his lungs, which was quite interesting. But the only singing I had to do, I was challenged in a cafe. I was taking my notes. This was in central Switzerland. And they said, "You, the writer, you must sing now."
Happens all the time, doesn't it? Let's face it.
So, because there had just been a men's chorale that had entertained us for about 20 minutes, beautiful Swiss singing. So I got up and I sang a little Irish ditty. I managed to pull that off.
You didn't jump into a rousing version of How Do You Solve a Problem Like Maria or something like that then?
No. I didn't dare do that. No.
The book is called The Alps, A Human History from Hannibal to Heidi and Beyond. It's written by Stephen O'Shea. It's out now at the moment with W.W. Norton and Company. Stephen, if people want to find out more about you, about the book, is there a website they can go to? Do you do the social media thing? How can they find you, and how can they read the book?
I could be found. I have a website. There's more information on this book and other books I've written. And it's all one word, Stephen O'Shea Online. com, with no apostrophe. I've dropped the apostrophe. Stephen O'Shea, S-T-P-H-E-N, O'Shea Online, all jammed together, .com.
Super stuff. It only begs the question, Stephen, now that you've climbed every mountain, etc., what's next for you? What's the next subject of your next book?
I'm looking at the Balkans.
And are they looking back? I mean, hey.
I don't know. I've I tootled around a bit in the Balkans. I cheated a bit. I left Slovenia, went into Croatia, and I found that, I don't write about that, but I found the Balkans, Croatia, to be fascinating. So stay tuned, watch this space.
Looking forward to that one, then. The book's called The Alps, A Human History from Hannibal to Heidi and Beyond. Fascinating stuff. 40 million people living in the Alps. Unbelievable. It's by Stephen O'Shea. Stephen O'Shea, it's been a pleasure to speak to you, and we'll speak very soon.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for your time.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.